Good morning, everybody. Oh, come on, say, good morning, Cam. Thank you for coming in. Our closing keynote for the show is going to be given by Richard Thieme. See, who has a lot of good things to say about himself. He's a regular speaker at DEF CON and Black Hat. He has an online column published widely called Islands in the Clickstream, and he is respected by both hackers and feds. So, and the subject of his talk is going to be not on here.
It's the last paragraph.
Well, it's on the program. Living on the edge and remaining committed to the ideals and practices of the open source community in a bunged up world. So, thank you, Richard. Please give him a hand.
Thank you very much. That's the danger of threading your own introductions, right? And not trusting the introducer. Subject is new ways of thinking about security, open source thinking in a bunged up world. And I know it's presumptuous to talk about living on the edge. It's just something that happened to happen. Let me do some housekeeping first. I see it's 11:29. Is that right? Is that correct? 22? Okay. So we'll still come in around noon. I find myself living on the edge because of the way I grew up. I was always socialized to live on the edge. I've changed careers, lives, places I've lived, major perspectives a lot. What that does is force you continually to recontextualize how it is you think about things. You don't take anything for granted, and you don't accept the presuppositions of the community in which you find yourself necessarily, unless you can relate them to kind of a bigger picture, a kind of meta picture that keeps emerging out of the multiplicity and diversity of your experiences. And so when you find yourself, as I did about 10 years ago, in a position of going into business for myself, it was the right thing at the right time, because suddenly people who had lived at the center for all their lives, that is, social, political, economic conditions, had been reasonably stable in terms of supporting a thought world in which they had moved to the center of authority, power, ability to make a living, suddenly found themselves more and more on the edge. It was a direct function of the information revolution, because as the speed of information increased, the structures through which it flows, the societal structures in which we live, began morphing more and more and more. And people who had lived on the center found themselves migrating to the edge, and they watched people on the edge move toward the center. And therefore, someone who'd learned to live on the edge suddenly became of limited value to them in terms of indicating what it is we need to do to keep constantly inventing and reinventing a structure of thought that makes sense of a diversity and often disconnected set of experiences in the open source community, which I think of as a community, as a thought world, which is much bigger than merely a commitment to Apache, which is nevertheless one of the most obvious and most successful manifestations of it. It's a way of living and a way of structuring reality that is sometimes really and genuinely at odds and conflict with other ways of doing it. And what I want to try to do today, in the limited time we have, and we'll have some questions at the end if you like, is simply raise consciousness on some of the deeper implications of what open source community really means, now more than ever, post 9/11, post TIA, post total information awareness, post the realization of the implications of globalization and a distributed networked world on the part of people in power who can now use the presuppositions of an open source community in a negative and damaging and inhibiting way, as opposed to how it is meant to be used, which is liberating and empowering and in a way that creates more and more opportunity, there is something very, very, very much at stake. So what we're looking for right now is something like string theory or superstring theory, which is a framework emerging over the last years in physics, last couple of decades, as a way to try to make sense of fundamental contradictions between quantum mechanics and theories of relativity. By looking for something deeper that discovers a language that nevertheless includes both the very small and the very large, the quantum as well as the relativistic cosmic scale sorts of things, we're looking for something that can connect the seemingly disconnected worlds of open source software and the hierarchical monopolistic structures that insist on having strong boundaries around information and therefore around identity. So, strong boundaries or weak boundaries, that is the question. What kind of boundaries are we comfortable living within and sustaining? Those that are semi-permeable and allow a frequent exchange of free information back and forth, or those that are more rigid and define ourselves like tall walls that keep other people and other kinds of ideas and information out. So I'm going to quote Matt Blaze, who a few years ago at Computers, Freedom, and Privacy said this: anything that is in the critical security path is potentially the weakest link in the system, including the definition of the problem. The definition of the problem, as seen by the implementers, and the real definition of the problem are often not the same thing. So, this is my premise. We have to be very clear and very conscious about what the real problem is so that we define the struggle appropriately and accurately so that we're doing the right things. My premise is that the structures of our information and communication technologies form us in their images. And I say this because I finally found myself old enough to have noticed the profound difference between how I was raised as someone immersed in the world of text. I taught English literature. I learned how text meant and how the engines of its technology, the book, organized us in response to our interaction with it. So when ubiquitous network computing emerged on the scene, I could determine that there was a significant difference between who I was genuinely becoming, who I in fact was being defined to be, and therefore how I framed possibilities as a set of actions toward the future as a different way of being. They form us in their image, and we must understand this for us to work effectively with them. Networks, as they have emerged, and as many of you just know habitually from the way you have grown up, are interactive, modular, and fluid. And therefore, human identity in all of its facets has become, and is increasingly becoming more so, interactive, modular, and fluid. And I'm just saying that this is fundamentally different from the way we perceived ourselves to be. Fundamental Blade Runner type human identity issues are what is at stake. Open source is a manifestation of an open, evolving, and free community. Therefore, it involves the best of complexity and chaos theory by defining structures as optimal, which are unceasingly open, evolving, and free, and that is congruent with an interactive, modular, and fluid way of living. Let me give you a concrete, mundane example of what I mean by modular. I live in the upper Midwest now. I've lived in different places around the world, and that gives you a kind of perspective of how people in the upper Midwest define reality. A couple of generations ago, in Milwaukee, but even in Minneapolis, or Chicago, or Detroit, or other upper Midwest cities, if you asked somebody when they were young what they intended to do with their lives, they would have first of all told you their name. Their name would have been the one they were given, and they would never have thought of changing it. If you asked them what their religion was, they would have told you what their religion was, and they would mostly never have thought of changing it. If you asked what they intended to do with their lives, their vocational preference, they would have told you where they were going to get a job or how their career would move, and they would never, over the course of it, think of altering it in significant ways. And if you asked what they intended to do if they were heterosexual and what they were going to do with their coupling instincts, they would say that they intended to get married and stay married. Each one of those things was linear, fixed, and inviolable because literally the technologies and the social, political, and economic structures that evolved from them didn't give them options to perceive or see that were any different than those that they framed as themselves. Now, I have, between us, my wife and I have 7 children, and one has already changed his name radically. He was a Smith, and one day we thought he was kind of kidding. He said, you know, Smith is such a generic name, I might as well be a generic. So when I leave here, I'm going to San Francisco to see my son, Scott Generic, and his wife, Maria Generic. And he knew what he was doing and that we can't think of them as anything other than generics. Now my son, another son, who's Theme, decided a better way to spell Theme would be X-I-M-M. So now that he is in sound art, if you go online, he just won a prize at the Third World Festival, which pleased us immensely, because they went on a typical eight-month honeymoon in Asia and recorded lots and lots and lots of sounds digitally and created structures with them and narrated them, and they won an award for it. You'll find him as Aaron Zim, and his wife is Bronwyn Zim, instead of who got married just a year and a half ago, Aaron and Misty, Theme. So you have the option of changing your name. I've changed my career. I'm in my third career, and it's evolving. Many of you, when you look forward, think of careers as modules to be compartmentalized and segmented over the course of an evolutionary trajectory. If you look at your religions, people convert, don't convert, deconvert, reconvert, and pick a spiritual lifestyle or perspective as an empowering platform on which to stand based on their needs and preferences. It's shopping. So every aspect of life, and of course people get divorced and remarried and have different ways of cohabiting, coupling, or grouping, and over a course of a lifetime people are going to do many different combinations and permutations of those. All of the things that we thought were stable, linear, and fixed as a result of having been given to us by the society in which we grew up are now modular. And the reason they are modular is that the structures in which we live socially, economically, and politically are functions of the flow of information and communication technologies. And that's why I mean it very deeply when I say that what we have is a symbiotic relationship with these technologies. Marvin Minsky said it so well years ago. He said, what do we mean by thinking? By thinking, he said, we mean the ability to hold in our minds simultaneously a multiplicity of representations of reality, some of which are mutually exclusive or contradictory, and to hold them all there simultaneously while we evaluate the data that flows into our lives and see which is a good enough map for now of the reality that seems to be coming into our lives so that we can make a choice of the model of reality to use. That's what we mean by thinking. We can entertain different possibilities and choose among them as the best guide for now. On the contrary, he said, people who only have one fixed and rigid module of reality in their heads and can't ever get outside it, we all have at least one in our family, I would bet. You know that they determine the arguments because they never can flex. They can't, you either move toward them or you move away from them. But he said we could even say of someone who only has one way, who is fundamentalistic about some aspect of life, that they literally are not capable of thinking. Well, he said, where is it the thinking is taking place today? It is taking place, he said, at that time on the newly discovered evolving and emerging network in which people were becoming nodes. And therefore, he made the case that in the future, i.e. now, those who are incapable of being in the network and knowing how to use power as a node in the network are going to be as useless as a desktop computer set on a table, pushed into a corner, disconnected from every other computer. They're going to be, he said, a brain in a bottle. And therefore, a human being will no more be able to be literally and fundamentally and essentially a human being unless they are a networked human being and know how to live and move and have their very being in the network. They will be like a child raised by wolves in a cave who has not learned to speak the dialect of his or her tribe. The symbiotic relationship which forms us and then we form the technologies and then they reform us, this is fundamental and it is real. Open source is the embodiment of the possibilities inherent in network technology for the good. And anytime something evolves for the good, immediately, call it what you will, the forces of darkness kind of gather around and try to kill the egg before it hatches. It's just what happens. Back in the days when I used to do S trainings, when I was very young, they used to refer to it as putting a turd into the space. What they meant is as soon as the space expands, which is what open source community does, expands possibilities, people feel empowered, people feel enlivened, people discover new ways of being, someone can't stand it because they need the more rigid controls and fixed limits and boundaries. It's about boundaries, and therefore they will do what they can to kill off the life that is evolving. It's not just economic, it is fundamentally psychological and sociological. People can't stand sometimes other people being so alive, free, and living in a trust community like an open source network genuinely is. So this defines some of the places it's going to come at you. Open source software, therefore, works best in a community or culture which is congruent with its assumptions. And as I said, from chaos and complexity theory, the systems that work optimally are those that are open, evolving, and free. And you know the metaphors from the speed of the flow of information. If it becomes too slow, it gets molasses-like, it gets rigid, rigidity shuts down the life in the system, it stops growing. On the other hand, if it gets too fast, it becomes chaotic and dissolves into structureless, free-formed nonsense or nothingness. And that life is optimized right on the edge of chaos, feeling as if we are about to be pushed forward into it, but there is a platform under our feet that keeps us somehow centered in free fall so that we don't fall into chaos. Okay. In terms of security, What ApacheCon really is about is sharing secrets. Part of what the pressure we are feeling today involves is keeping secrets secret. Now, as the economic and political changes of the last decade took place, before 9/11 announced to America how the world had already become for almost everybody else. Before then, we saw it coming, but it was more of an academic exercise. The friends I have at NSA say, you know, it's not like we were stupid. You see, we did seminars about it. We wrote papers about it. We published in journals. We met in rooms and discussed it. And it wasn't that we didn't get it. Everybody got it. But we got it at a level of cognition that was kind of abstract and academic and kept us once removed from the genuine impact which, for many Americans, September 11th delivered as a visceral blow to our understanding, so that suddenly everybody said, oh, this is what we mean by globalization and the dark side of distributed networks. This is what we mean by the flexible interface being everywhere. So you have to have an overview to make sense of data. And that overview is provided in the intelligence community by a shared schema, which people must already share in order to understand the value of any datum within it. In other words, you already share a matrix. The people in the intelligence community, like CIA, who worked against the KGB, often discovered that they had more in common with one another than either one of them did with their own political system or nationality, because they shared presuppositions and had emerged from it like a cloud of power that didn't have a name yet. And I'm going to say that several times, because we're trying to define structures that don't have a name yet. And so they found that in the intelligence community, they had more in common with each other than they often did with the spawning environments, the petri dish, which had grown them, because they created rules of action for themselves, which were separate from those the rest of us in our communities were sanctioned to obey. Once network technology began being invented by hackers in the best sense of the word, all the real hackers, you know what I mean. We don't want to have that argument about crackers, hackers, and all that. Real hackers invented a network technology which showed that the power to burst through boundaries, which previously had been sanctioned for spies by states, was now delivered into the hands by the technology itself, the hands that knew how to use it. And this was one subset of the hacker community. It was people who discovered that boundaries suddenly disappeared, like the clouds of power that emerged from the intelligence community networking with itself outside of the national structures that created it. Real hackers discovered themselves in a cloud of power. Open source is one such cloud, which burst through the boundaries that previously had contained them, and therefore they needed a new kind of name. Okay? When Poindexter announced last week, or it was announced to us that Poindexter had said, you know Poindexter, do you remember him? Convicted felon under the Reagan administration, and now currently administering total information awareness. I don't say that slightly or trivially, which is a way of breaking down the boundaries between information domains. He used the very language that we are familiar with in open source. He said, what we've got to do is break down the stovepipes that separate commercial and government databases and allow teams of intelligence agency analysts to hunt for hidden patterns of activity with powerful computers that cross all of the boundaries, private life, public life, commercial life, non-commercial life, police computers, marketing computers, advertising computers, everything. So we have to develop a way to cross-reference and database everything, he said. Now, the only way to fight a network is with a network, and this emergence testifies to that fact. He is talking about creating a network in the image of the network to fight a terroristic network. So it is not the fact of the network itself that matters most, because we are all evolving into networked beings, as Minsky predicted we would, but what kind of ethos does the network hold, and does it hold people inside it accountable to that ethos? So what defines the open source community is not merely a commitment to open source, because Poindexter's words could be translated into this convention and said by one of you in a different context. The question is, on behalf of what goals and agendas, on behalf of what objectives, and how are people held mutually accountable to staying true to those goals and to that ethos? So what is asked of us? Marshall McLuhan said, nothing is inevitable so long as there is a willingness to contemplate what is happening. That means, quite simply, being as conscious as you dare to be and seeing the implications of what you do when you write code and share that code in the way you do because of what you are creating. It has implications for society on a global level. It is not trivial. It is not trivial. It requires leadership. Now, a lot of you do not think, I am sure, sitting wherever you sit with your laptop open before you, coding away, that you are exercising leadership, but that's exactly what you are doing. Because leadership means seeing clearly and saying clearly what you see with such clarity that people around you recognize it as the truth coming together, configuring itself in a visible, visual way in front of you, and seeing how obvious it was, but which they did not see before you said it. Now, I have a friend who does whitewater kayaking. And he said, I've noticed an interesting thing when you're coming up to the rapids in a kayak. You see the whitewater foaming, and if you focus on the rocks as you go through, he said, you always hit the rocks. But if you focus on where the water goes, you always go where the water goes. Now, that is my definition of what leadership, in its essence, is about. It doesn't require structural authority. Many of you work in organizational structures defined by the hierarchical parameters of prior technologies. And you know what it's like when a CEO or someone who has structural authority, like the guy I witnessed once, came out. He'd read a book called Zap, and he got into empowerment, and he wanted to empower his whole workforce. And he called everybody together for an all-hands meeting, and he said, you're all empowered. And then he went back to his office. And he thought he had exercised leadership by announcing the new regime rather than building the structures of training, constant reinforcement that helps a culture or society move from one state to another. But there was somebody in that crowd, as you know there is often in your office or wherever you collect yourselves, whether online or off, who listens to what he said. You've been in meetings where the person with structural authority is speaking and your eyes lock across a table with someone. And in that silent moment, you both know what each other is thinking about what the person is saying, but you can't say anything because of the structure of the meeting and power in the environment. So you don't say anything then, but once the meeting is over, Dilbert style, somebody rolls up their sleeves and says, well, I think I know what he or she means. I think it's like this, and I think this is what we need to do. That is the person exercising functional leadership in the situation. They may never be acknowledged for it. But especially in the domain of technology, where so many non-technologically sophisticated people literally have no clue what it is that you're doing with your lives, your brains. It is not easy to explain what it is you do, but if you say what you see clearly or model it by what you do in a community like this, people will get it because that's what's congruent with networked life at its optimal. See, leadership has two components, at least. One is saying, and the other is simply doing. And doing that which people recognize as appropriate in the situation, you cannot overestimate the impact of modeling that kind of appropriate behavior. The same guy who went whitewater studied karate, whitewater kayaking. And he said he lived karate. He breathed it. He did it every day, always at the dojo, internalized everything he was learning from his master. And then it became so much a part of him that he didn't even have to think about doing it. And one night when he left the movie theater late at night and was headed down around the dark corner toward his car, a hand came out of the darkness, grabbed him by the shoulder, and without even thinking, whoosh, he turned and he broke his assailant's neck. And I said to him, yes, and he said, yes. And what I learned from that circumstance was this. Better make sure that what you're practicing is what you want to do, because when you don't have time to think, what you are going to wind up doing is what you have been practicing. It's another aspect of leadership. It is making the conscious choice to do that which, when you do not have time or the circumstances will not allow you to think, is what you have decided you want to do. I'm suggesting that we can't always know what that is unless we're in a community that supports us with an ethos or ideals or goals and objectives or a way of thinking that really makes sense. And I'm trying to say that you cannot overestimate how open source community is this, means this, and does this. So this is not a trivial enterprise. This is really one of the outposts of light. Is what you are learning and what you want to do, especially in relationship to security, what you want to do when you don't have time to think. How does the approach of open source thinking set parameters, show ways of learning methodologies that can become contagious and habitual?
What gets in the way of that vision? See, what I think you've learned how to do is exercise power in distributed communities. And by power, let me quote Charles Reich, who said, power means to me pretty much the same thing as freedom. It's that thing that everyone has the most of that they possibly can have. Anything that comes out of you and has impact and goes out into the world is power. When you reach out to another human being through the energy or creativity in you and another responds, you are exercising power. When you force someone against their will to do something, that is not power but force. And force is a negation of power. Back to the structures of open source and hierarchical monopolistic organizational structures. That is not power but force, and force is the negation of power, and that is why the freedom that is intrinsic to our very being, which is the ability to respond to all and every circumstance as you direct and not as circumstances direct, is the essence of power. Now, I keep referring to 9/11 and distributed network political and economic structures. The relevant context in which this power is exercised today is what I call the mind of society. It's a hive mind, a familiar concept from those of you who network, in which you find yourself losing yourself interactively and becoming a module or a node in a network that has a being and an identity which, even if you don't know the name of it, you feel move, live through you. You are part of something larger than yourself. You are not merely an individual with boundaries. The boundaries, again, dissolve, soft boundaries. I said several years ago for a talk at Black Hat before 9/11, and therefore not everyone understood exactly what I was trying to get at. The mind of society, how it is shaped, how it is governed, and how it is aimed is both the target and the weapon in the new battle space. And that's because in the digital world, the world itself is theater. And we are in a chronic state of warfare. Low-grade intensity warfare is unceasing in a networked world where power is exercised the way I defined. But not everybody knows this, and you can't be conscious of exercising power in it unless you are willing to become conscious. The September 11th attack was theater. And the terrorists, I know, counted on the media to do their work. The media amplified and directed the projection of force into the minds and hearts of this particular society in a way that the terrorists themselves could never have done. The networks are filters into the mind of society. And I don't have time, but could go off at nauseam into the way the media through the 20th century evolved in concert with propaganda and public relations as disciplines and arts to become the primary means by which perception is managed. And therefore the media became implicitly an ally, at least in collusion, used by the mind of society to aim terror at the mind of society. And because this kind of warfare is ubiquitous and unceasing, it does require a different mindset because something very real is at stake. And this is where open source thinking is a fundamental threat to the proprietary ownership of intellectual property and ideas. Again, it's about boundaries, a function of technology, the technologies of the Middle Ages, above all the printing press with movable type, transformed the meaning of intellectual property. Before the printing press, 1452 emerged and was ported into other cultures, transforming the human identity. People did not have a concept of individuality, did not have a meaningful concept, therefore, of a boundary around an individual, or therefore that that individual had rights, or therefore that the work they created was intellectual property, which also somehow had rights associated with it. This all had to subsequently evolve in response to the revolution caused by the printing press. You go back to monasteries and ask a monk working on a manuscript. They took information from other manuscripts in other monasteries. They paid no attention to boundaries, authorship, or ownership. They were foreign, alien concepts. And therefore, things like, well, the Lord's Prayer is one example. Some of you know that it ends, "For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen." But the person who wrote that was, in fact, transcribing text from one book into another and got so excited with the previous end of the prayer that he wrote in the margin, "For thine is the kingdom," and the next scribe took that, thinking he had left it out inadvertently, added it onto the prayer, and a subsequent generation, i.e. everybody, learned a prayer that in fact had not been said in that form because boundaries were not important, nor who owned it. And therefore, long tracts in the 18th century in this country, get a political tract from the Revolutionary War, and you will see all kinds of quotes, long quotes of other people, unattributed, because it wasn't important until we evolved a notion of ownership of intellectual property. It was a function of the technology, which simultaneously defined the boundaries of nation states themselves as appropriate levels of complexity, political, economic, and social, for the flow of information and communication, which was extant in society at that time. And that is the very fundamental revolution, that network distributed electronic communication from the minute the telegraph emerged. It's about a 200-year revolution, of which the internet is merely the latest and most obvious manifestation, but it began with the telegraph, and that is what is being fundamentally undermined and sabotaged, and that is what open source is about. How do you define property when you share the information back and forth? I was doing some consulting with a college in Milwaukee not long ago, and they said one of their biggest problems, seriously, was teaching the kids what plagiarism meant. And I said, what do you mean by plagiarism? Well, attributing sources and so on. And we just kind of deconstructed it and saw that all their notions of documentation and attribution came from having been taught by the world of text, where the boundaries around text and personality began and ended. And the kids who are writing papers, swapping information back and forth, cutting and pasting, as the technology leads them to do, literally cannot grasp in the same way without assiduous back formation in text thinking, that the meaning of what they are putting together and collaboratively creating is not the same for them as it is for these people who are trying to teach them about an increasingly archaic notion of plagiarism. It's not about stealing, it's about boundaries getting softer and the identity of the human being dissolving and disappearing into a collective or communal identity. Used to be nation states, not anymore. Clouds of power have emerged in which we function, which obliterate nation states. I'll be speaking next week in Ireland. No better example, a different historical point of reference for how the common market emerged. I lived in Europe in the 60s, I lived there in the 70s, and that could be progressive markers of the dissolution of boundaries and the emergence of something else. Boundaries and borders define the individual and the organization and the society and the civilization and the species. They are arbitrary. They are functions of technology. Security is a function of clear boundaries. Identity is a function of clear boundaries. Privacy is a function of clear boundaries. Intellectual property rights, loyalty is a function of clear boundaries. But as I keep saying, boundaries and borders are not clear. So who do you trust inside an emerging cloud of power? And where do you look for the image of how a community functions best? Now, I know of no better image, take away the ethos, than the black hat hacker community. Because no community that I know shares information faster without regard to where it came from. People want to be acknowledged in an elite form for what they have contributed or thought through. But in the community itself, as I am told by the people who try to counter that community in security, the information is shared immediately. And therefore, our police, national and international structures of police, policing in regard to security of information, had to have evolved their own networks that look like that. You can't fight a network without a network. But that means you have to learn who you can trust and how you can trust them. And trust is based on knowing who you're dealing with, and that is exactly what is up for grabs, and that's why it's so difficult. We don't know the names of what we are dealing with. Originality and creativity, according to Nietzsche, is the process of giving something a name. He said a creative thinker is somebody who just leaned forward, maybe 5 seconds ahead of the rest of the herd, the hump of the bell curve, and saw first what was coming up over the edge and gave it a name. And then it created a context in which we lived and moved as if it was real. How you name things gives to societal structures, gives to people outside your communities possibilities that they didn't know they had. Quick, trivial example. The United States government subsidized mail planes to carry mail in the 1920s when airplanes flying from city to city was a new thing. Cost a lot of money. They decided they needed to cut back. There were people who hopped on the airplanes and caught rides with the mailbags. They had a name for them. They were called aeronauts, just as we have astronauts. This is how quickly these examples become obsolete. When I first used this example 3 years ago, it wasn't as clear where space tourism was headed, because all we knew was the name astronaut. And we were just beginning to evolve the notion of a space tourist, into which category you could put yourself rather than into the highly trained trajectory of necessity for an astronaut, so that you could see yourself as a space traveler. They wanted to cut subsidies, but they couldn't say we need more aeronauts, because people literally could not see in themselves the identity and being of an aeronaut. So they needed a new name. So they invented a new name. You know what they call them? They call them passengers. And now that we had a new category of thinking, a new structure, people could step into being a passenger. I could be a passenger, and therefore, 70 years later, all of us are passengers on an airplane and literally don't think anything about it. That's how new content disappears into the background and becomes context. The joy of living on the cusp of a revolution is seeing what's coming up over the edge, like the Terminator on the moon reveals the craters and rills and valleys of the structures on the moon, right where the light hits the darkness. You get to see it for a moment in a flash before it disappears. The implications of computer security long ago told me where society's structures were going. The nice thing about growing older is you have some track record and you can base some of your previous statements, you can even quote yourself, because you turned out to be right about some things. I said in the 80s that the societal structures that were going to emerge in networks and define security would inevitably define societal structures of security, and that's what total information awareness and all that other apparatus is about. You lock down the network, you harden the application, you harden the operating system, you make sure that you harden the application, you provide perimeter defense, but above all, you then have to attend to the social reality of the network, which, as you know, is the insider, quote unquote, but with morphing boundaries, who is inside and who is outside. That's where you define policies that make it seem simple and clear, but it isn't. Just like KGB CIA, as I defined, formed a cloud of power. Now there are ex-KGB, and ex-something is not an identity. You have to have a positive identity. What is it that you are in that cloud? We don't know the name yet. You have to give it the name. But that's where society is moving. So when I want to see where things are going, I often look at computer security, and I encourage you to do the same. Turn it into a metaphor. This is as recent as last week. This is Aviation Week and Space Technology. And this is simply a quote. What we need now, according to the military leaders who are trying to make net-centric warfare really work with interoperability, which, as I said, breaks down boundaries between Air Force, Navy, the single platform of interoperability, makes the distinctions of the past obsolete. What we need, he said, are common protocols for imagery and signals intelligence that define a common data link. Now, when you are used to dealing with technology as technology, that sounds like exactly what it says. I encourage you to see it as a metaphor, because this is the definition of the future of the world. It's one of the pointers. What we need in humanity in the 21st century, he is really saying, are common protocols for imagery, a shared understanding and language, and signals intelligence, i.e. multivalent, multispectral detection of all sources of information in the environment, whether biological or chemical or informational, so that they can freely flow back and forth through interoperable common platforms that create a common data link, and therefore a single, as I call it, mind of society. Okay, I'll finish. It's not a new communication system, he went on. It's not a faster computer. It's not a new platform or sensor. Those things are necessary but not sufficient. It is the social structure of networking, protocols, and rules of interaction applied to multiple machines so they can collaborate and provide mutual support to one another. That's the definition of open source community at its best. There needs to be mutuality, collaboration, cooperation. There needs to be frequent feedback and a freedom of flow of information and communication. But above all, there needs to be accountability, which can pop out here and there in any complex system, wherever the interface manifests itself. Holding people, calling people to the accountability that gave rise to people, I think of Richard Stallman, I think of him as a saint. I literally do. Because of what he is capable of seeing and saying, the man not only has a mind that is beyond most of us, he also has a soul and a capacity for understanding, which only a single-minded, obsessive, compulsive of the sort that we all aspire to be can manifest. That, to me, is sainthood. All saints are a little crazy. They wouldn't be saints if they weren't. But it's the essence of the open source community at its best. It is what you are, in fact, by your participation in it, called to be and to become, as fully aware as possible of the implications of what this technology is doing for the Blade Runner mind of society as we manufacture memory, identity, and personal presence in genuinely new and heretofore unnamed forms. Okay? Man says I should stop. I'm going to stop. You have any questions? Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And he asked me if I had, was I sure I had 45 minutes? Man, got 45 hours. Any couple questions now, or, you know, I've got cards available. I'm available online, themeworks.com, T-H-I-E-M-E-W-R-K-S. Our theme, or actually anything, at themeworks.com. And the columns I write are free, and they're all on the web, and they take off in rants very much like this one. All right, if you have questions you want to ask later, I'll be around for a while. And thank you for allowing me to participate with you in this form. Thank you.